This is Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide.
Good morning. Welcome to Talkback Gardening.
Good morning, Deb, and good morning, gardeners, particularly the gardeners have got their notebooks handy and they're ready for Darren Ray. He is the climatologist here in South Australia who's independent, and he also provides a wonderful three-month weather outlook for home gardeners. And the big question is, when will it rain? The question I want to ask him, why isn't it raining? And that will be after 9 o'clock. But with wonderful gardening weather, it's the time to get out there and plant cool season vegetables. We've been talking about this for quite some time, Deb. But which are the vegetables to actually grow at this time of the year? And Stephen Hoffner from Wagtail Farms, he'll be along very, very shortly talking about all the kind of winter vegetables that you can grow and how you can get maximum performance from them.
Excellent. So stay tuned for both of those wonderful guests. Later in the program, I have a couple of brand new ABC Gardening Australia magazines to give away, so stay tuned for that as well. The phone number, if you've got a winter vegetable question and you'd like to speak to Stephen Hoffner, the number to call is 1300 222 891, 1300 222 891. We'll get back to general talk back gardening a little bit later in the program, and we love your comments on 0467 922 891, which is the text line.
So if climatologist Darren Ray is correct, we're going to get a break in the season in the middle of May. In the meantime, we've got warm soils, warm temperatures, and the absence of heat waves, ideal for planting winter vegetables. And we were suggesting that maybe this season winter vegetables could become quite expensive, so growing your own could be the way to go. Stephen Hoffner is a vegetable agronomist and he runs Wagtail Urban Farms, and he advises a multitude of vegetable gardeners and organisations on how to establish vegetable gardens and get satisfaction. So it's good morning to you, Stephen Hoffner.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Deb.
So we've been talking about get out there and plant your winter vegetables early. Why? Could you explain what's going on from a plant's point of view that they benefit so much from early planting and warm soils?
Yeah, well, quite often we plant, when we start thinking about winter veg, when it starts to get cold. But from a plant's point of view, the soil, if it's not warm, the plants, they're little chemical factories. And I always like to think when you're doing a chemical experiment, in high school, you use a Bunsen burner to warm things up to make them happen faster. And it's exactly the same with the plants. Their roots have to be nice and warm for all those chemical reactions to occur for, good growth. And if you put the plants into the soil when it's cold, you don't get that. So you have stunted growth.
So we come back to those soil temperatures. So what's an ideal soil temperature for the plants to sort of power away? And when the soil temperatures start to drop, at what temperatures do they start to slow down considerably?
Yeah, it depends on what you're growing. A lot of the Asian vegetables, they can handle a lot cooler temps. But really that window between 10 degrees to 17, once it gets down to 10, then everything really starts to slow down. But, how it is right now is perfect for getting things established.
Yes, that's 20 degrees now, and probably by the end of April might be down to 16 degrees, but that's still pretty good. If you plant now, how long before you get a harvest? And again, depending, let's say we're putting in broccoli and cabbage and Asian veg.
Yeah, look, if you get broccoli in now, especially the the cut and come again, the sprouting varieties, you'll be harvesting by June. And you can actually get a double season, because obviously right in the middle of winter, things stop growing. But as spring starts approaching, if you've got a very well-established plant, then you can get a harvest, once they start waking up again, August, even if you get it early enough.
Many happy returns with broccoli. Could you just explain the fact that there are probably at least two different types of main strain of broccoli?
Yeah, so you've got the heading variety, and then you've got that sprouting variety. You also get broccolini, which you can have a very long harvest with. You know, if you keep feeding it through the growing season, which I think is also an important sort of subject to talk about, the actual feeding of the soil.
We're talking with Stephen Hoffner from Wagtail Farms, and if you've got a vegetable question, now's the time to come in with that particular question.
So the number is 1300 222 891 if you'd like to call in for Stephen.
And okay, so there's the two different types of broccoli. One that's just has one head, one big head, and it's delicious. Whereas the other type, you cut it and it comes again with little smaller heads. There's also broccolini. Now broccolini, I think, is the commercial version of it. But there are other types of broccoli that would be worth growing.
Yeah, I mean, my preference is the cut and come again one, because like in our household and most of the households that I deal with, you know, growing just one takes up a lot of space, whereas if you grow the broccolini or the sprouting broccoli, then you get that extended harvest. And often, you know, if you dedicate a lot of space in your vegetable garden to just growing one broccoli, that's one meal, whereas with the broccolini, you can have, you know, additions to many meals. So I find they're a better one to grow.
All right, and so the broccolini, they're ones that have the stems with the little broccoli heads on them, but they're cut and come again type of veggies, the same as your sprout resprouting broccoli.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you can get varieties of heading broccoli that once you harvest, they continue to produce side sprouts as well.
Yeah, but it's never quite the same, though, is it?
No, it's not.
Let's move on to cabbage. Cabbage was king once, and everybody grew cabbage. But maybe the interesting thing is there are many different types of cabbage. Which are the cabbages probably that'll give you the quickest and best results by planting now?
So we used to grow a very large cabbage, which was used... It was used for making cabbage rolls. They took a long time to grow and get a harvest, whereas, you know, if you go to something like your wombok, the fast-growing Asian cabbage, it's got a very short life to harvest. Everything in between, you know, you just want to make sure you get them in early enough so that they form that head. I think that's the biggest problem with all the cabbages is when they're put in late, they don't get enough sunlight hours and they don't develop enough, you know, big leaves to catch the sunlight to actually form that lovely head. First vegetable would be grown in South Australia, by the way, was a cabbage.
Ah.
I think they thought, if we can't grow cabbages, we can't live here.
Our special guest is Stephen Hoffner from the Urban Farmer with Wagtail Urban Farms, located right in the heart of the city. If you would like to ask a vegetable question, call in now on 1300 222 891, 1300 222 891, or you can send us a text on 0467 922 891 if you have a comment to make.
This is Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide.
We are talking this morning to Stephen Hoffner, urban farmer from Wagtail Urban Farm, and we've just been talking about cabbage, the very first vegetable planted in South Australia, which is a fascinating fact indeed. If you have a question about any winter veggie, now is the time to call on 1300 222 891.
Before we finish the cabbage, we're used to the typical kind of cabbage that you've been talking about, but Chinese cabbage, is that a cabbage, a proper cabbage? And how effective is that as a vegetable to grow at this time of the year?
Yeah, as far as I know, it's a brassica. All of the brassicas, you know, fall into that category. They're all related, so they all grow very similarly. I find they're great. I really like the all the Asian vegetables, you know, bok choy, the wombok, all those sorts of soft, fleshy, you know, tatsoi especially. They're just brilliant because you can cook with them, stir fries, you know, nice warming sort of dishes, or you can eat them fresh in a salad. So, like, if you're having for lunch, you can duck out and just pick some and, you know, chop up a wombok and put that into a salad, and it's just so fresh and, you know, such a lovely food to eat.
All right. Okay. And certainly the Chinese cabbage, they're a sweeter cabbage, and probably those that are sort of sick and tired of having cabbage leaf meal after meal, find a Chinese cabbage, you might find that far more acceptable. But bok choy, just quickly, just describe what bok choy looks like, because it's got tremendous potential. It grows so quickly, and it's one of those cut and come again veg.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like very upright plant. It's got very fleshy stems. I remember I'd only ever eat it in, you know, again, stir fries and dishes. But then someone served it to me once. It's just a salad, just the bok choy chopped up with lemon juice and a bit of vinaigrette. And it was just amazing, like, you know, a little bit of olive oil too. So really versatile vegetable.
Okay, and just quickly on a few others, peas, good time for peas?
Yep, great time for peas, although I was always told plant peas and beans at the beginning of autumn and spring, and one will thrive and one won't, so it depends on how the season goes. You actually get, because sometimes the season doesn't go very well, and you'll find beans will do better. So I think that's a good tip.
Well, I think the good thing is if you plant in both peas and beans, you're going to be a winner one way or the other.
Exactly.
Stephen.
We've just got a couple of calls for you, Stephen. Venton in All Kings right. Park has joined us. Good morning, Venton.
Morning. How much sunlight should the broccoli and the cabbages get?
Yeah, great question. As much as possible. You know, they say 10 to 12 hours. You know, as the sun goes and dips down low on the horizon, you get a lot less hours. Unfortunately, everything that, you know, sets the plant back will delay harvest and reduce harvest size. So, you know, if you can plant your vegetable garden in the place in your yard which receives the most light, and if you can't, you've really got to reduce the, you know, whatever plant you're trying to grow, either reduce your expected harvest or, try and find a sunnier spot.
Thanks, Venton, for the call. On the text line, Stephen, Ingrid in Burnside says, which winter vegetables are least susceptible to slugs and snails? There are so many in Burnside. They ate an entire capsicum plant in 2 days last year.
Oh, yeah, that's a hard one. It's better to try and reduce the places where they can hide in your garden than try and plant things that they're not going to eat, because no matter what you plant, it's going to go through a young stage, you know, an immature stage of its growth, and that's when they're most susceptible. So yep, trying to reduce those nice wet spots where there's, you know, lots of cover, often keeping mulch away from the garden. And this is another thing, we're so taught in Adelaide to use mulch to reduce evaporation, but in wintertime we need that sunlight hitting the soil, warming it up, so it's actually counter. You need to reduce that mulch layer and get the warmth into the soil. But yeah, the slugs, you know, that should, you know, keep them at bay.
That's very, very sound. And it's population dynamics. And I would suggest a program, a campaign to actually reduce the population beforehand. So you get these little traps, all kind of different kind of traps. There's heaps of them. But you can attract the slugs in particular and the snails into the traps and do that over a two-week period. Reduce the population, then plant your seedlings. Shouldn't have the same problem.
Helen in Collinswood has phoned in about cauliflower. Hi, Helen.
Hi, good morning to you all. When I have grown cauliflower in the past, I get the heads forming, and then suddenly, as I think the heads are going to stay compact, the florets start to split and grow upwards, and I no longer get a lovely compact head. How do I stop that from happening?
Yeah, often that's a sign of stress. So there's been some sort of stressor, whether it's lack of sunlight, a change in watering, anything like that. It just makes the plant think, oh no, I'm not going to survive. I need to flower and get my seed out really quickly. So trying to reduce those stresses around, especially as they're starting to form. Another trick that a lot of people do is they pull up the highest leaves around the head and just tie them together with some string, and that sort of stays the growth of the flowers, so they sort of have like a little roof over their head, and often they'll clump a little bit better, and that sometimes protects them a bit better too. Maybe you can give those things a try.
Great. Thanks for the call, Helen. Anna in McGill asks, can winter veggies be planted in a bed where summer veggies have been grown?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the best thing to do. You just have to really concentrate on feeding, because summer veggies, they've got so much more vigour, so much more sunlight, so much more warmth, and they'll take all the nutrients out of the bed. So you've really got to add, add nutrients. And I think I heard you talking about, John, about organics and the benefits of them. One of the major benefits of organic fertilisers is that the plant only takes what it needs. It's not forced to take any extra up. And so if you've got organic fertilisers in the soil, lots of compost, you've lifted the soil with a garden fork to make it nice and fluffy, and you've got adequate water, as soon as you put those seedlings in, they're away. Raised beds often do better in winter because they're up above the ground, so they're able to warm up a bit better with the available sunlight, and then you get a real jump on the season.
Stephen, I was going to ask you what to do to get the plant started, but you've just described that, so I think I'll say thank you very much for some very sound advice on growing winter vegetables.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Stephen.
Everyone's gardening.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us this morning on Talkback Gardening. And I have to say that on the text line, this texter says, I grow broccoli all year round under insect net, never fails. Also with cabbages and cauliflowers getting good growth in summer and autumn, allows a long up to 9 month growing season for them before harvesting in spring. The long, slow maturation through winter is ideal. Planting seeds on Christmas Day is my recommendation. My mother did this every year. Love to know where you're calling from with that advice. That's fantastic. Not so this texter who says, I planted a punnet of kale Monday. By Wednesday, they were all eaten down to stalks, even with snail pellets sprinkled around. Thank you very much for that. We're heading back into general talkback gardening calls now. Chris is in Seaview Downs and has a question about passion fruit. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Good morning. Look, I have a beautiful passion fruit, which I planted about 3 years ago. It's on a north-facing fence. And last year we had probably about 250 fruit. This year we had around about 300. But unfortunately, I would say at least a third of them had no pulp inside, and the skin was very, very thick. We fertilise with a mixture of manures and water regularly. And I'm just wondering, is it going to be something where we may have to pull out the vine?
I'm afraid so. Did you plant a seedling or was it a grafted?
It was a grafted.
Was grafted. And they are far more susceptible to virus. What you're describing there, Chris, is the effect of a virus. It affects the fruit, and to start off with, you don't get the pulp inside the fruit, and then you'll find that the next thing is, as you're about to describe or saying, the skin becomes very, very thick and distorted. Yes. And at that stage, in fact, before that stage, I'd be pulling it out. In fact, it would be a good idea to remove the vine now, freshen up the soil, lots of organic matter, and then maybe, if you want to, replant in springtime, but don't put it in exactly the same spot. Move it to a metre or so to either side of where you were. But tremendously important to improve the soil before you actually get going. And that next time, rather than put in a grafted tomato, you pay more for them, but they are more susceptible to virus. And so many people are saying, look, the seedlings are far better in terms of their performance and less likely to come down with the virus, or it takes longer for the virus to get them.
Right. Oh, dear, that's a bit of a shame. It's beautiful. It's still green and lush. But,
that's right. If you're getting so many fruits, and and maybe you're sort of saying, right, oh, well, there's 200 fruits and I still get pulp in 100 of them. That's better than most people are getting on their plants anyway. So at some stage you need to say enough is enough, and it's important that you spell the ground for at least a season, maybe two seasons before planting. So if you're going to keep them for a little bit longer, get rid of them, say, in summer, and then don't plant until the following spring.
Okay, thank you very much for that. I'm very disappointed, however.
Oh, thanks for the call, Chris. Sometimes it is bad news.
It is, unfortunately. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Look, the texter that said that they grow broccoli all year round and it never fails grew up in Keith, where Mum used to do it every year, and is now in Highland Valley. So there you go.
Interesting, yes. And I mean, it's a cool season vegetable, and in like the southeast, certainly you can grow them right through the year. Mm. It's that hot, dry weather that probably brings growth to a standstill here in Adelaide.
Yes. Carol is in Pasadena with a mandarin question. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning. We have a mandarin tree that's never been very prolific. In fact, last year we only had one mandarin. But this year we've got about 60 fruit. They are large like oranges and they are bright orange. Do they mandarins come from oranges, and do they revert back to oranges?
Now, the tree itself can't change, can't revert, but what more likely to happen is that the rootstock that you're growing the mandarin on is probably a sour orange or could be one of the many different types of citrus which have got extra vigour, and because of their vigour they use them as a rootstock to grow something like a mandarin, and you'll find that somehow the sucker, it's suckered, and that growth is coming up into your tree, and right. The longer you leave it, because of its vigour, it takes over, and you end up with a sevel orange or a sour orange, and you don't have a mandarin tree left.
No, so it's not a mandarin tree now.
I think if you can, try and look down and say, righto, well, look, here's where it's coming out of the ground, and this sucker this branch is coming from out of the ground, whereas if there's still some mandarins on the tree, you could trace that back to where it comes down to the rootstock. And it would be possible maybe if it was only a small amount of suckering and reversion to chop off the old and go back, or chop off the suckering and go back to the original. But I think you'd be much better off. Take it out now, improve the soil, get lots of composting material and animal manures into the soil now, and get yourself ready for planting probably towards the end of September.
Right. Yes, it's unusual, to see them like this.
Well, it could be that rootstock, Carol, so go and have a look. But thank you very much for calling us this morning. Daryl is in Stirling. Daryl, you've got a camellia question.
I have, thanks, Deb. Yes, good morning to you and to John. We've got many large camellias in our garden up here at Stirling, and we've got one in particular about 3 metres high underneath a pergola on the eastern side of the house. Now, it's growing through the top of the pergola, so we would have liked to bring it back down to about half its height, and it's a white one, and we're just wondering whether it's better to do that before or after the flowering.
After flowering every time. You could cut it back now, it would send out new growth, but you would lose probably 80 or 90% of the flower buds. They start forming back in around about November, December, and if you've got a camellia bush at home, you'll probably take a look at it, you'll find that the buds are starting to swell now, and now's the time to put a little bit of extra fertiliser and make sure that they don't want for water. But in your situation there, Doug, I think if you can, wait until after flowering, and you can cut it back very hard then. If you do, it'll come into very, very strong growth, and take the tips out of that strong growth so that you end up with a bushier branch, a plant, rather than a tall one.
Wonderful. Thank you, John. Yes, and apropos your comment about strange things happening, we actually had Sasanqua camellias flowering in March, and the Japonica started on the 1st of April.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. I'm trying to fit in a botanist or somebody that can explain to us the effect of seasons. It's all to do with daylight, the hours of sunlight, and in particular temperatures. And our temperatures have been so atypical, and they really have got a lot of plants crazy mixed up kids.
They certainly have.
Including in your garden, Daryl. Thank you. Thanks very much for the call. And John, I have to say on the text line, we're getting a lot of people talking about whether they can summer prune their fruit trees. We've got Kate from Millswood asking about peach. We've got someone from Fulham asking about peach and nectarines, asking can they prune them this weekend?
Well, I'd say that if your tree is strong and healthy and putting on vigorous growth, prune now. Don't prune as hard as you probably would if you had have done maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago. But you can summer prune now, and that would be an ideal thing. But if you haven't watered your tree and it's buttoned off and it's got that hangdog look about it, don't do it, because nothing will happen. You won't get the growth that you want is needed before winter. So do your summer pruning. Probably last call for summer pruning. Do that either this week or maybe next weekend if you can.
And how much do you take off for summer pruning, John?
Oh, well, it all depends on what you want to do. But I would be taking off no more than, say, a third of the canopy if you want to reshape it. And if you're going to cut it back harder than that, you'll forego probably the fruit or the flowers or whatever you want from your plant in the following season. But say for a fruit tree, something like a peach tree, cutting it back, the longest, strongest branches, cut those back by at least a third, and the side branches, cut those back by about 50%.
Well, we have, as you said, John, had very warm temperatures. The big question is, when is it going to rain? And that is one that I know you will be putting to our climatologist, Darren Ray. And we love your talkback gardening calls on 1300 222 891, 1300 222 891. And you can always send a text through on 0467 922 891 with a comment. And I've got a couple of ABC Gardening Australia magazines to give away as well, one by phone and one by text.
This is Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good morning. If you are just joining us, lovely to have you on board for Talkback Gardening. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Deb. Good morning, gardeners. And in South Australia, the good gardening weather continues. For how long? We're going to find out very, very shortly, because temperatures are sitting in the low 20s. No hints of heat wave. Ideal planting weather, but we were a little bit concerned about how dry it is. It's 9 weeks now since we've had a significant rain. So why isn't it raining, and when will it rain? And Darren Ray, climatologist independent, will be our guest very, very shortly.
He certainly will. Looking forward to that. If you would like to jump in the queue for our Talkback Gardening this morning, please call in on 1300 222 891. If you'd like to send a text comment through, and we've got quite a few at the moment, the text line is 0467 922 891. I have a couple of ABC Gardening Australia magazines to give away this half hour. We'll do one by phone and one by text. So if you want to get yourself ready and put your name and full postal address, please do so. We are really keen to find out, when is it going to rain, aren't we, John?
Yes, good morning. And I think the person that's going to solve that problem is Darren Ray, climatologist here in South Australia. Darren, it's been uncomfortably wet in the eastern states, yet here in South Australia it's been, I think, unseasonably dry. And the big question from a gardening point of view is, how long before we receive some significant rainfalls? And the question I want to add to that is, why isn't it raining so much at this time of the year? So, good morning to you, and let's take a look at why is it been so dry?
Yeah, good morning, John, and Deb, and all the listeners out there on this beautiful autumnal morning. Interesting one. There's lots of warm water around the eastern states, and that's been feeding. It's currently feeding a lot of moisture into weather systems over on the east coast. Little bit of a different story for us. We've had a little bit of cooling happen in the ocean temperatures to the northwest, so we're losing one of those components from rainfall, so the moisture feed. And we've also seen a little bit of a switch in the some of the weather patterns that have been supporting, dragging moisture down from the tropics. We've lost that a little bit over the last month or two as well. So that, you know, that contributed to the events we saw in the early part of summer. So yeah, we've lost a couple of the features that have been supporting rainfall. And so the question is, okay, when's that going to change? The other interesting thing is that in the moment, in the oceans at the moment, is what's happening out in the eastern Pacific and the possibility of La Nina. But we'll come back to that.
Okay, well, I think that maybe, I mean, you're suggesting, I mean, that it's the oceans, and what's happening in the oceans is critical to our weather, and because there's cooling in the weather waters to the northwest, why don't we take a look at the Pacific and see what's happening there? There's El Nino out there that's been responsible for a lot of strange weather in the eastern states. That's coming to an end, and I suppose the big issue then is it going to become a La Nina? So just give us a heads up on what's happening with the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, so you just nailed it, John. This time of year, whatever's happening over summer just finishes up through typically March or April, and we've had the El Nino event that kicked off back in late spring. But, you know, unusually wet one with some influence dragging some of that record ocean temperature moisture down from the tropics. What we are seeing in that signal, and that's the strong signal in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, is weakening off. And we're starting to see these cool temperatures emerging in the last few weeks out over Guatemala, Central America, part of the world. And if you look at the ocean temperature profiles, there's arrays of buoys that measure temperatures down through the oceans. You can see this big pulse of cooler water sitting underneath the surface water that's moving its way up to the surface. So it's pretty clear, direct observational evidence of, we're certainly going to have a go at La Nina this year over the next few months.
There is a bit of debate over La Nina. Some of the international weather models are saying neutral. Some are saying no La Nina. What does Darren Ray say?
They have settled down a little bit more in the last few weeks, and the majority, probably three quarters of them are going for La Nina at the moment. Given what we're seeing in the direct observations of the ocean and the modelling settling down a bit more, it's looking pretty certain. And, that combination of, record ocean temperatures quite possibly sitting underneath the La Nina influence for, weather conditions for Australia, it's going to be pretty interesting second half of this year in terms flood risk.
So there it is. There's a potential for rainfall out there in the Pacific, coming in from the Pacific. The other thing from South Australian point of view, and you have highlighted this on a number of occasions, what's happening in the Indian Ocean? And the Indian Ocean, if we have a negative dipole, I think that's the one, would also
dipole.
Give us... Dipole, that's right. Got to get it right, John. Yeah, anyway, tell us what's happening in the Indian Ocean and its likelihood of adding to the moisture.
Indian Ocean Dipole, IOD, so it's measuring two different ocean temperatures in two different parts of the northern Indian Ocean, out near Africa and out near us. Yeah, there's still a little bit of mixed opinion in the modelling. Normally you'd get a negative IOD with La Nina, so if La Nina goes off, that's certainly what you'd say. But interestingly, some of the models are still going for positive IOD, which tends to be dry, but that would be pretty unusual in a La Nina event. So still a little bit of mixed sort of signals in there. Once again, suggest the majority of models are suggesting it's going to go, the wet phase, a negative IOD, through from late winter onwards. And peak in August, September, and that's really could really significantly wet things up.
All right, and that's what the picture that you're painting is, that there's the potential for wetness to come our way. So let's move into it month by month. Here it is. It's April, and I think in the past you've been suggesting it may be a dry month. What's likely to happen in terms of rainfall and also temperatures?
As I mentioned, we've got those cooler ocean temperatures to northwest Australia influencing South Australia. The tropical activity has been a bit patchy as well. So basically what we're looking for is, couple of different waves coming together. That's been a bit patchy and a bit, uncoordinated. Through next few weeks, we've got one of the waves that's having a bit of a go at the moment, but it's not really doing much. And so we get a few millimetres out of that in the system on sort of Monday, Tuesday. And then it looks like having another go just around the sort of 15th, 16th, 17th of the month. And that looks like it could be a bit thundery in the weather models. And so there's some potential there for some significant rainfall. But it just, it's a fair way ahead and looks a bit patchy. So it's a bit hard to get too overexcited about that. And then looks like it probably wait till the end of the month. So it's probably going to depend, we'll get a few millimetres early next week. Could highly variable amounts, sort of mid-month. It could be significant, but it could actually not be much. We could end up at the month with not a lot of, at the end of the month, not a lot of rainfall. Milder temperatures, so lots of sort of low 20s through the next, out to mid-month. A little bit of warming up and then cooling off again, warming up again at the end of the month. So, overall, a little bit above average for the month. But,
all right, so above average temperatures for April. Coming back to rainfall, I think the rainfall for April is 44 millimetres. Will we get the average or well below?
No, I doubt that very much. We could well end up with, lucky to get 10 millimetres, really.
Oh, goodness.
It's going to depend on that system mid-month. If you get a thunderstorm come over the top, could change the picture significantly, but it's pretty patchy looking. So, not a lot of rainfall, but Butte gardening weather, John. So,
oh, absolutely. I don't think gardeners will mind that, providing they've got access to water. So, okay, there's April, May. Move us through May, and I think you have been suggesting a potential for a break in the season type of rainfall around about the middle of May. Is that still on?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. The ocean temperatures could still be a bit on the cool side. The tropical activity does come together a little bit, so... I guess it looks like most likely through weeks 2 and 3, pardon me. So that's when the sort of tropical activity starts to come together a bit. Ocean temperatures might be a little bit cooler than what we might like in terms of moisture supply into the system. So, I don't know. I'm sort of sitting on the fence a little bit with this one, John, unfortunately. Yeah.
All right. Will that come through as just a showers building up or a decent kind of a rain?
There's a fair period there. It looks like, right through weeks 2 and 3, there's significant band of tropical activity that's looking like it'll build up, and sit around for a fair period there. So, it's a good chance of getting something significant through that period.
All right. Well, average rainfall for May is 68. What do you reckon?
I don't know. It sort of feels like it might struggle a bit with that as well.
On the fence.
That's all right. But that's there's still a potential for a break, enough rain for a break in the middle of May. But if that doesn't happen, when's the next bet best?
So things weaken off. It looks like it gets a little bit warmer last week of May, and then early June kicks off again. So it looks like we get more tropical activity coming through that first half of June. So that's a really good chance of getting some decent rain. First half, the second week, not so much. Looks like it switches off again, and it'll probably get a little bit warmer for that time of year. So a little bit on and off, and we're just sort of at the moment we're just lacking that moisture feed from the cooler oceans.
You want to have a go at June rainfall? 71 is our average, but what's the likelihood? At that stage, it's wetted up and we might get near average.
I mean, the most of the modelling's got things starting to head into that, sort of early negative ID, slightly in La Nina-ish kind of signal. So it could be starting to wet up by then. So it just depends whether, that sort of La Nina signal kicks off. And that pushes warm water from the Western Pacific around through past Indonesia and Papua New Guinea up to the northwest of Australia. So that could actually be warming things up by then. So, providing that moisture feed. So, we could be, by June, we could be into that sort of, things starting on the early phase are starting to wet up.
All right. So the picture I'm getting is going to be sort of dry for this part of autumn, and then as we start to move towards winter, there's a potential for starting to wet up. Take us through winter. Are we in for a wet or a dry winter?
Yeah. Overall, I'd suggest wet. that La Nina influence and that, you know, influence it has on the ocean temperatures looks like it'll kick in as we go through winter pretty significantly. And that's pretty typical. You know, so negative ID starts off typically so June, July, and then it increases and peaks in August, September, October, and that signal is pretty clear in the modelling. And so it's all, you know, it's looking pretty consistent with that sort of pattern. So, you know, getting wetter as we go through winter, and particularly so, there's a fair number of the models have got things pretty wet in September, October. So, yeah, certainly one to watch out for. And I'd suggest to people, you know, just really keep that in your back of your mind that it could start getting very wet as we go towards the end of winter and into spring.
For the last two or three years, we've had that situation where late winter and early spring can be rather wet. Could we get flooding rains?
Yeah, absolutely. There's certainly some risk of that. Certainly. I mean, as I said, there's still a little bit of uncertainty in the modelling at this stage, but, you know, the majority of them are going in that direction. And given the record warm temperatures, modelling's got some very warm ocean temperatures kicking in around off to the northwest of Australia and around northern Australia. So certainly very much a risk of developing in the second half of this year.
Yeah, a very interesting situation. I look upon it as chalk and cheese. It's one way at the moment. It's likely to be quite different by the time we get to spring. And obviously there's a lot of variation between now and then, and trying to interpret that is not easy, I guess, Darren.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, I remember being asked by a farmer once, you know, picking up on that, they're a bit of a signal between if the wet first half of the year is dry, the second half tends to be wetter and vice versa. And there's a little bit of something in that. But it's not a strong signal, but it can be something that you see a little bit happening. So that tends to be bearing out a little bit with what we're seeing at the moment.
Okay, Darren. Well, so April temperatures probably above average, rain below average unless we have that storm activity. May temperatures around average, are you saying?
Yep.
Yep, and rain, you're on the fence about, depending on whether we have a really good downpour in weeks two and three. June temperatures average also?
Yeah, around average, I think, yeah. It's going to be interesting when the first half a bit cooler and the second half a little bit warmer for that time of year.
So it might even out to average. Yeah. And rain, it really depends, and our next best chance of a break is the first half of June. So let's hope we certainly see that. Well, Darren, as always, fascinating stuff. And what I love is that you give us the information behind the modelling, which is, you know, the stuff that you're looking at. And it's a lot to do with the ocean temperatures. So, as always, thank you very much. Really appreciate you joining us this morning.
Yeah, thanks, Deb.
Thank you. Our independent climatologist, Darren Ray. If you'd like to hear that back, you can go to our ABC podcast. Just have a look at the ABC Listen app. Download it onto your smartphone if you haven't done it already, and you'll find Talkback Gardening there early next week. We're going back to Talkback Gardening in just a moment. You can call through on 1300 222 891.
This is Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe.
On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
If you haven't won anything from ABC Radio Adelaide in the last month, then call in on 1300 222 891 or text 0467 922 891. We'll give one ABC Gardening Australia magazine away by phone and one by text. But let's go to Kay in Strathalbyn now. You've got some whitefly in your garden, Kay. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, I've had whitefly for 4 years. I've done neem oil, echo oil, soapy water. How can I get rid of it?
I think the answer from your point of view is a chemical called Success. Success. Okay. Yeah. Success Ultra. It's a bacterium. It's specially formulated from organic materials, but that was its origin. But it's very, very low toxicity. The nice thing about it, from a whitefly point of view, is that the chemical is what they term translaminar. When you spray it, it goes into the actual leaf itself, and it stays there for a couple of weeks and is quite effective for a couple of weeks. It doesn't kill the white flies, like a typical sort of insecticide. It stops them from feeding. Now, the important thing is with white fly, you see the flies flying around, and the white flies don't do too much damage. It's the nymphs or the baby stage of the white fly. And if you look at the backs of the leaves, you'll find these little opaque scales there. And the thing is, if you use success, because the scales are, and a scale is hard to control with a chemical anyway. So there's the little nymphs or the babies hiding underneath this scale. And because if you're using success, it's translamator, the chemical gets in there and gets into the scale itself or underneath the scale and kills off the baby, a white fly. And you'll find that Success Ultra is very, very successful in controlling white fly.
Is there anything I can put in the soil? I'm sort of really digging everything out. And you say it doesn't do any harm. It doesn't do any harm. It's terrible.
Right. I mean, if you wanted to, you could use Confidor. But I wouldn't be using Confidor on anything that's edible.
No.
You could spray it onto the foliage, but Confidor can be very effective in controlling a lot of sap-sucking insects on leaves of ornamentals by actually drenching it into the soil, and it's taken up by the roots and goes in round the plants into the leaves, knocks off the little sapsuckers and often some of the little small grubs and lerps and things like that. So, but I wouldn't be using Confidor on something that you're going to eat, and it's the kind of a chemical you need to sort of just understand that it can affect bees, and so when you apply it is very, very important. But you, go for success. It really is. You're not going to cause any harm. It's very specific. Mm. It only controls the soft, sap-sucking insects like whitefly, and it does minimum harm to the environment around it. And I think you'll find that's very effective.
Thank you, Kay, for that. Hope it works well for you in your garden. Congratulations to our magazine winners, Anthea in Littlehampton and Judy at Norlunga Downs. We'll have another two to give away next week. Julie is in Blackwood with a potted bulb question. Hello, Julie.
Good morning, Deb and John.
Tell us about the problem.
Well, I'm not sure if it's a problem that a lot of people have, but every year I plant bulbs in pots, and they're just ordinary plants like daffodils, snowflakes, little Johnny jump ups, that type of thing, hyacinths.
Yeah. And they give you lots of colour every year.
Yes, they do.
Okay. You must be a good gardener because, if I can interrupt there, because when you grow bulbs in containers, often people don't put enough nutrition in there. And so over a number of years, you get smaller and smaller flowers because you're not getting the nutrients back there. But come back to your story. What's the issue?
Well, I've always been a bit doubtful about the time to dig the bulbs up and put them in a plastic paper bag or something to keep them ready to plant the next season. But I'm just wondering, what is the correct way and time to do this for the different bulbs, please?
Right. Well, I think it's probably, if you're growing them in containers, it's a good idea to take them out of the container, reorganise your soil, improve the soil, and then put the bulbs back in a very early in autumn. But some people just leave the bulbs in the container, and as I say, if they don't get enough nutrients into the container, you start to go backwards in terms of performance. So the answer to your question is, when they have finished flowering, wait 6 weeks. 6 weeks after flowering, you can cut the leaves back, and if you wanted to, take them out of the containers, take all the soil off it, and put them in a little paper bag or somewhere where they're nice and dry and out of the sun, and then you start your replanting in autumn. And depending on some people like to get their bulbs in nice and early, round about now. Other people wait a little bit longer. That can have a big influence on when they flower.
And then what to do with them, Julie? Is that the other part of the question?
Yes, where is a good place for them to reside, if you like, until it's planting time again?
Somewhere where it gets morning sun. In fact, most of the bulbs, winter flowering bulbs or spring flowering bulbs, they'll take full sun. So I would suggest if you're going to, when are you going to repot or get them going again?
Oh, well, I haven't decided because each year I've sort of had a bit of a different opportunity to plant them. And so I'd just like to know how to do it properly. Yeah.
Are the bulbs still in the container or did you take them out last springtime?
Half have been removed and half are in the ground.
Whatever. The important thing is get some good potting mix, get some extra compost in there, some organic fertiliser, put that into your container, plant your bulbs, and I would be planting in the next 2 or 3 weeks while the ground is nice and warm. That way you'll get early flowering and you'll get your flowers in late winter, early spring period when often there's not very much colour. So now's the time to do something and get them going again.
Thank you, Julie. We're really at the end, but we'll squeeze Tom in because he's been hanging on very patiently in Laura. Just a quick question, Tom.
Okay. We have some stone fruit trees under which the mulch is white gravel. Now, during this dry summer, I've been watering them by dumping bucket loads of water on them. I'm wondering if that needs to be spread around the root zone.
Well, ideally, if you can, have a little ring underneath the drip ring. If you're familiar with the drip ring, that outer area, have a little moat there and put your water there. That's the biggest concentration of water. But could I say, Deb, that at the moment, next season's fruit crop is at stake for people that haven't watered their gardens for the last 2 or 3 months. The ground is very, very warm, and you'll find that now is the time that fruit trees should be gathering nutrients and storing it for springtime. That's not going to happen in dry gardens that haven't been watered. So if you want a fruit crop next season, I'd suggest not only Tom, but anybody else that's got fruit trees and hasn't watered their garden for some time, give your fruit trees a big, deep soak this weekend.
And the drip line, you're saying, that's sort of where the canopy ends. Kind of the roots are underneath and they're around about where the canopy is above.
Yes.
And that's where you need to put your water, isn't it? Not at the base of
the tree.
That's
right. Imagine if it rains, you'll find that the water drips off the canopy and most of the water drips off at the outer end of the canopy, and that's the concentration of water, and the roots are pretty smart. They've figured that out. That's where the biggest concentration of roots are. There's plenty of roots in other areas, but that's the area to focus on if you've got limited water.
Good luck, Tom, and to all gardeners this weekend who might be giving their fruit trees a big drink. Just a last reminder, please complete John's Good Gardening Newsletter Tomato Season Survey 2024. It closes on Monday or Tuesday of this week, and we want your information whether you had a bumper season or whether it was a total disaster.
Absolutely. Have your say, and we'll report back on the results of that in 2 weeks' time. Just a quickie. Next week, I won't be here, but Marilyn Kuschel, wonderful friend and colleague, will be in my seat, and she'll be talking autumn colour with Mark Oborn from the Botanic Garden. So, program not to be missed. And I'll say until next week, or the week after, good gardening.